This is the Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Thanks for listening. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. So, the United States may be a secular nation, but did you know that Congress has begun every session since before there was a Bill of Rights with a prayer? In the new book, When Rabbis Bless Congress, Howard Mortman explores that weird tradition while paying special attention to Jewish religious leaders whose first appearance in Congress came in early 1860 when a pro-slavery Sweden-born rabbi named Morris Raffel addressed Congress weeks before Abraham Lincoln was sworn in as president. Raffel's exotic garb was received warmly by both Southern representatives who were very Christian and the New York Times, which was even then kind of cosmopolitan. This is a book for lovers of congressional history, for junkies of congressional history, says Howard Mortman, who tells me that the content of the prayers add up to an interesting off-kilter history of the nation, from slavery in the Civil War to the Depression and World War II to Vietnam and women's rights and to more recent things. The addresses made by religious leaders are a great mirror of what we as a country are experiencing. Now, for the past decade plus, Mortman has been communications director for C-SPAN, the cable network that provides live coverage of Congress and a variety of related programming. He got to start working for former Housing and Urban Development Secretary and former Congressman and vice presidential candidate Jack Kemp. And he was a producer at MSNBC's Hardball with Chris Matthews before that network's decision to go hard left. He also worked as a columnist and on-air host of an early web show for National Journal's Hotline. In a discussion about the rise of the internet and decentralized news sources, Mortman tells me that the past 25 years have seen constant change in legacy media and that there's really no question that the New York Times, NPR, and most cable news outfits are rightly understood to be more biased than in the past. He says if outlets were more upfront about that and if they strove to be fair to the views they disagreed with, the loss of trust and confidence in media would be less worrisome. If you're sleeping with elephants, you can't cover the circus, says Mortman, paraphrasing the old Times editor Abe Rosenthal. The rise of new voices and new perspectives in news is great, he says, but if you're going to build a strong reputation and really add to the conversation, you've got to be believed and respected even by your opponents. This is a really interesting book and a really interesting conversation, and I'm very happy to present right now the Reason interview with Howard Mortman. Howard, thanks for talking to Reason.
Thank you, Nick. I appreciate it very much. Thank you.
So, you know, just as a starting point, if you are not religious or if you're not Jewish, certainly, but if you're not religious at all, why should we be interested in the intersection of religious address and Congress?
Yeah, so if you take the religion out of it and you take out the Jewish part of it, what you're left with is the Congress part. And this is for the book, and the subject is for lovers of congressional history junkies. This is part of what Congress has been doing every single day, going back to the very beginning of Congress. The first thing they do in every session is pray. They pray even before there's a Pledge of Allegiance. This is a book and a project narrowcasting for one particular religion, but the history of this has never been written before. Why does Congress pray at all, big picture, and what is the history of it?
So why, and we'll get to the first Jewish address of to Congress by a Jewish by a rabbi in a second. But why does Congress pray every day? You know, you hear wildly differing accounts that the U.S. is a Judeo-Christian nation. Before about 1950, that was always America is a Christian nation. They added Judeo, at a certain point. But then you also hear, all of the founders were deists or skeptics or agnostics. Why the hell are we praying, every day?
The easy factual-based answer to your question is because the founding fathers wanted us to pray, wanted Congress to pray in every session. So they wrote it in. The first thing they did, even in the Continental Congress, was to hire a chaplain and have that chaplain begin Even the Continental Congress begin with a prayer. The first prayers happened in the House and the Senate before they even ratified the Bill of Rights. So we're talking about 1789 here. So the really short answer, this is probably not the big picture philosophical answer you're looking for, but the flat out factual answer is because this is what the founding fathers wanted.
What was the nature of the early prayers? What were they praying for?
It was a very Jesus oriented prayer. It's a very Christian praying for the birth of the nation. This is the beginning of a country, and let's thank the Almighty and for giving us this providence and using all that language. So it was a very much, there's a Presbyterians leading the prayers in the early days and all sorts of reverence. Some members of Congress were very religious. They too prayed in Congress. It was a big crossover in the early days. So it is a tradition that goes back to the very beginning of Congress.
And now I'm thinking of a bad episode of MASH and a number of, kind of very special episodes of different kinds of sitcoms. God hears all the prayers. Sometimes the answer is no. Did God ever, was there a moment, I don't know, during like the War of 1812 where they were like, God smote the British before they burned down Washington, D.C. And it was like, the answer was no.
There's an old joke. If you talk to God, you're religious. If God talks back to you, you're Christian. It's funny you mentioned 1812. War is very much part of a theme of prayers in general. Again, we're talking about, this is not a Jewish part of the conversation. Yeah. It's just broadly, what are they praying about when they pray? War is a huge part of this. And War of 1812, the Vietnam War dominated the prayer messages. World War II, on the eve of D-Day and just all the big moments in battle, that messaging, that language was part of the language that the chaplains used. So it very much, the prayers themselves, the language reflects the sweep of American history. I mean, there have been prayers about the space mission, prayers about the environment, prayers about civil rights. The past year, we've come out of over 100 prayers mentioned coronavirus or COVID. In the prayers by the chaplain. So these are very much reflecting what America as a whole is experiencing, but put in religious language for Congress.
So let's fast forward to 1860, when it's the first time that a rabbi addresses Congress or opens Congress with the prayer. Who was that rabbi? And, what did he talk about? And how was it received? Because, it's not like there were a ton of Jews, kind of wandering around 1860 America, right?
Yeah, you're right. And in fact, the first prayer, so here's where it gets really interesting. And again, now we're going to go really deeply narrow, but it's going to be broadly applied. So 1860, the first rabbi, guest chaplain, first fill-in, a guest chaplain is someone who fulfills the duties of the chaplain when the official chaplain's out there, kind of like Joan Rivers, sitting in for Johnny Carson kind of thing. So the first rabbi.
Yeah, so a real American gets sick and a Jew fills in, right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yes. So 1860, the first rabbi in February 1860, Lincoln wasn't even president yet. James Buchanan was president. The eve of the Civil War, first rabbi's name was Rabbi Morris Raphael. And a couple things about him. He was kind of a celebrity rabbi at the time. Actually, you're talking about going through and speaking. He did that. He traveled the country giving Jewish sermons throughout the country. And in his prayer, he talks about he alludes to the looming Civil War. He talks about brethren and we should, come together, brothers and sit with brothers and so on. What's really interesting about Rabbi Morris Raphael, he's from New York, born in Sweden. He was pro-slavery. He supported the Confederacy.
Of course. I could see all of our Nation of Islam listeners. Of course.
Everything needs a plot twist, and that's the first one. So here's Rabbi Morris Raphael, pro-slavery, first rabbi, praying in Congress. Now, you're saying, and you're correct, saying, well, what was it like to be there and for the first time seeing a Jew in front of you when you probably have never seen a Jew before in Congress? And it was a shock to the system. All the members of Congress tittering to each other and pointing. And the New York Times was dismissive. They referred to him wearing his costume, his canonicals. So just a very odd sight to see a rabbi in a yarmulke and a tallis and giving a the first Jewish prayer ever. So that itself was newsworthy, not necessarily for the right reasons, but just, hey, look at the Jew in Congress right now.
But was he warmly received or dismissed as, you know, just kind of a freak by members of Congress?
You know, it's funny. I want to say warmly received, but the record shows a little freakish. It took a couple more rabbis praying over the next couple of years for it really to gel, saying, you know what, they have a place in this tradition of prayer. So I want to say it was great. Everybody, kumbaya moment. Yeah. It really wasn't, though.
What had there been a Catholic addressing, a Catholic priest or chaplain addressing Congress before, or did a Jew get there first?
No. You know what? I don't know that answer. Let me say that it's predominantly, I mean, they've all been Christian, the chaplains up to that point. I don't want to say I know the answer. I don't know the answer. What I don't get into, because Christian prayers are the vast, and this is obvious, vast number, predominant number of prayers in Congress since the beginning, I would be ill-equipped to kind of chop it up and say,
right,
Praise Methodist and so on. So I'm going to guess there were very few Catholics at that time. And I say that because it's only recently, so the first Catholic official chaplain came onto the scene in Congress. So again, we're talking about, you know, the chaplain position in Congress. The House has a chaplain and the Senate has an official chaplain, both taxpayer-funded positions. They have staff. And it was only until recently that Catholics became part of the official chaplaincy.
The reason I ask is because, I was raised Catholic, but I know there was only one Catholic signer of the Declaration, and that many states had laws on the books, kind of denying Catholics the right to hold public office up, you know, and those were more on the books than observed. But there was a lot of anti-Catholic feeling that rumbled throughout the 18th and 19th centuries, and then it started to abate in the 20th. But so there's an interesting kind of parallel with Jewishness. You know, like, so after 1860, after the first rabbi talks, what are the big themes? Like, when do Jews get tapped? When do rabbis get tapped to address Congress? Is it because certain topics are coming up and they're like, hey, we really ought to get, you know, a Jew in here? Or is it just happenstance that, you know, the Protestant chaplain, you know, tied one on the night before or something like that?
Nick, that's a really solid question. Like, how do Jews get in the mix routinely? So stepping back a second here, just to explain why there are guest chaplains. Typically, a guest chaplain of any religion is sponsored by a member of Congress. It's a clergy member, man or woman, who is somehow prominent in the community. These aren't donors. These aren't top, you know, campaign contributors. You know, these are flat out community members, respected members of the community, who are close to the member of Congress. That's typically. So the number of rabbis who have done this guest chaplaincy in the scheme of things is tiny. It's about 400 rabbis have prayed in Congress about 600 times. Many rabbis have given two or more prayers. So in the scheme of every session of Congress since 1780s has begun with a prayer. So it's a tiny, but writ large in the Jewish community, it's a big story of, here's, yeah, a big slice of Jewish history there. They don't necessarily pick the guest chaplain based on religion. Sometimes there is a theme. Sometimes the theme is like military chaplain's day. And so they'll pick a military chaplain, not necessarily broken down by a religion, but someone to talk about the theme of the day, of recognizing the military. So it's kind of, it kind of slices that way. It doesn't, one of the strengths of this, in my opinion, is there's no government mandate saying X person has to be X religion. This just happens organically that religion pops up there.
How, you know, talk a bit about the kind of intersection and whether or not there's a necessary clash between the idea that the United States is a secular nation. You know, we leave our religion at the door in terms of having, laws forbidding people of certain religions or having to be religious in order to hold office, et cetera. Jews as a minority, as a persecuted religious minority, you know, pretty much everywhere, in the world. And Is it a good thing that religion and kind of Congress are intertwined, or is that a little bit cause for concern, or how does that sit with you?
So, Nick, you've nailed that. That's the core of this whole thing. I mean, the core of this is church state, but also, do Jews feel comfortable in a Congress where the predominant religion is Christian, where typically the prayer by a non-Jew concludes with, in Jesus' name, amen.
And as you detail, and we'll get to this, any number of congressmen over time were like, that Jewish rabbi talked pretty good for a guy who killed Christ. So it's like, it's loaded for sure.
Yeah. So like on the face of it, not the easiest gig to, not the easiest, as easy as a synagogue, a tough gig, all there. A couple things to answer that. I would argue, so here's, putting my C-SPAN head on, I don't have opinions, not going to argue anything, but I will argue this, that looking at the Jewish community, the fact that there have been 400 rabbis who have given over 600 prayers shows the comfort that Jews should feel in government, in the legislative branch, that this is a government that welcomes those prayers. Israel does not, the Knesset does not open with a prayer. So if you are a rabbi in Israel and you feel like praying in front of a legislative body, you have to come to America to do that. This is a country that welcomes that. Another point to make is for people who argue the establishment clause, that Christianity is an established religion, again, the fact that 400 rabbis have done this, for me, is evidence there is not an established religion in America. Now, you're very valid in saying, well, okay, there's no established religion, but still, Mortman, come on, it's all Christian anyways. And it is. I mean, the word Jesus appears many times from the Christian prayer. So it's that big comfort zone. But, this is a practice of prayer in Congress that's been protected by the Supreme Court. Prayers open city councils, prayers open inaugurations, prayers open political conventions. It's very prevalent, and Jews are part of that mix.
Do you think people who are against public religion, public displays of religion, are they right to be kind of annoyed?
You know what? This practice of prayer in Congress has been challenged by atheists. They've gone to the courts. And they've said, you can't do this. Now, the courts have ruled against them every single time. And again, they rule against it because it's rooted by the founding fathers. I mean, this is just our tradition. So they don't like it and they overturn it. And I will tell you, it's a very valid reaction to say, I don't get it. I've talked about this book, Jews, whoever, say, okay, the history is interesting, fascinating, let's learn about this. But I still don't understand why they do this. And that's just, this is just the tradition that we have.
Have there been any Satanists yet, or, chaplain, like satanic chaplains, openly satanic chaplains?
Openly, who have addressed Congress? I actually, in all seriousness, I've had the question. I've been the Wiccan guest chaplain.
Yeah.
Now, I would say this, not to my knowledge, based on what you say openly, but there have.
But who knows what's in a person's heart, right?
I will tell you this. I kind of alluded to this in the book, but there have been rabbis who have gone to jail, prayed in Congress, who ended up in jail for any number of reasons. So they are.
Well, there's any number of congressmen who have ended up in jail too, right? Yeah.
These are chaplains who look like America, as they say. It's reflective of what's in your heart. I don't know. But I actually toyed with having a police blotter chapter in the book.
Yeah.
That would open me up to a whole different problem.
There have been Muslim chaplains as well, right?
There have been Muslims. There have been Hindus. There have been Native Americans. The Dalai Lama has prayed in Congress. That was his
title. Dalai Lama. He's a monarch. He's the last great, aristocrat. I thought we fought a revolution against that.
Well, after he gave his prayer, this about 10 years ago, Harry Reid sponsored him, and Harry Reid had him come join him on the floor of the Senate right afterwards. So you see this shot in this video. You see Harry Reid and the Dalai Lama right after he gave his prayer. So it really will blow your mind, Nick, if you're a skeptic.
Have there been, I assume then there have been Mormons as well?
Yes. There have been. I'm blanking on who. I will tell you, there have also been the big celebrity evangelist Billy Graham, Billy Graham's son, Gary Falwell's son. They've all been up there giving the prayer.
Speaking of police blotters, right? Jerry Falwell Jr. is really, he's outpacing his old man on that. You know, let's talk a little bit about some of, you know, part of what the book brings up, which is really fascinating to me and deeply disturbing, is, you know, the level of explicit anti-Semitism in Congress and the Senate. And, you know, Theodore Bilbo from Mississippi, you know, is kind of like, you know, his star shines brightly when it comes to all kinds of bigotry and racism. What was his response to Jewish rabbis talking before Congress?
Well, so he's really interesting. And here's one of the neat things about doing this research, neat in terms of like stuff, is that the congressional record over the last couple of years is now available online and searchable. You can really just search him. Who's the other? Rankin is
right.
The other one. So all these beauties of him.
And I just want to point out, for if anybody is like a kind of you know, deep cut kind of congressional historian, Rankin from the South, not Jeanette Rankin, I believe, who was from the Pacific Northwest, who was famously the first woman elected to Congress. She voted against entry into World War I, had her political career basically destroyed by that vote, got back in office just in time to vote against entry into World War II because she was a pacifist, and just has one of the most amazing kind of political careers. But we're not talking about that Rankin. We're talking about a different Rankin.
Rankin, exactly. So all these guys back in the day, back in the 30s and 40s, you know, someone like, you know, Bilbo and others, they just kept hammering it. I mean, you can say, well, you slip of the tongue once, I'm sorry, forgive me. But I mean, Rankin at Bilbo just kept on, Jews are communists. You know, it's like just like flat out saying it over and over. You know, they can't be trusted in the military, because their allegiance and all that. And it's one of the things, and again, I'll use the word neat, but just it's not in a happy way, but just it's so interesting just to go back and see language that these members used back then, anti-Black language. Some of the things, some of the Democrats, you know, Southern Democrats used to talk about, now Blacks, African-Americans, but back then really stereotypical language. It doesn't hold up well to history.
Well, you open and close the book with quotations and memories of Robert Byrd, the senator from West Virginia, who, among many things, is, you know, he's famous. I think of him first and foremost as a guy who, like Radar O'Reilly in the old MASH TV show, was slowly mailing home. In the TV show, Radar is slowly mailing home a Jeep from Korea to Ottumwa, Iowa. Robert Byrd was not so slowly mailing home the federal government to West Virginia piece by piece. But he was also famously a member of the Ku Klux Klan in his early career. What was his... You know, why is he at the beginning and end of your book? And what was his kind of, orientation towards Jews and towards rabbis talking in Congress?
Yeah. First of all, Nick, thank you. You're the only one who's ever picked that up. And I appreciate that part of it. Robert Byrd is prominent in this story. So Robert Byrd segmenting out, you know, all the appropriations for West Virginia, his history in the KKK. One segment of the Robert Byrd story that doesn't overlap with the others is his love of the Senate, his history of the Senate, Senate procedures. He's still the authority. He wrote books about Senate history.
Yeah.
So going back and looking at the history of prayer in Congress, Byrd's in the mix. Robert Byrd has talked about that. And I have video, I've seen it, I've clipped a video of him introducing rabbis, getting really excited that there's a rabbi here. And you know, and mangling the Hebrew of their names and the synagogues, but still thrilled to have, you know, I'm trying to remember what he said, introducing one rabbi, you know, this rabbi is here as God filled his nostrils with life and spread it throughout the world. So is this rabbi spreading the prayer, you know, elaborate, you know, instead of saying it's great to be here, you know, pleasure to be here, it just like goes on and on. So he got into it because it's religion in the Senate, religion in government. So for him, it was, you know, religion had a place in the government. And that's, you know, so he wrote about that.
If we might shift gears a little bit, you have been, you graduated from the University of Maryland College Park. In 1988, you are a kind of longtime denizen of the swamp, of the greater D.C. area. You started your work at the Republican Jewish Coalition. I'm reading off your LinkedIn bio. You put this into circulation. You worked on the Bush Quail presidential campaign and the inaugural commission. You were you worked at HUD under Jack Kemp. I want to talk about, and then you moved into media as well. For a long time, you were at National Journal's Hotline. You were at MSNBC before ending up at C-SPAN, where you're director of communications. I'd like to get your sense of, over the past 25 years, what has changed in D.C., not just in politics or in Congress, but, more broadly about the kind of general landscape. And could you give a summary statement? How do you think things have changed over the past quarter century since you've been working, in the government, in politics, in media? What are the big changes, and are we in a better place or a worse place, or is that kind of thumb up or thumb down the wrong way to be thinking about things?
No, I love it. Let me approach it this way, just from a viewpoint of a media guy, so I've worked in the media and all that. I love what's happening now. I love that we no longer are reliant on the three big networks to tell us what the news is, shaped largely by the New York Times opinion page. I love that more and more people are allowed to have their own opinions on what's happening, and more people have more platforms to express their own opinions. I'll say this just as a C-SPAN guy, our purpose is to put the hearings on TV, let people see how politicians are spending your money. You go to your thumbs up, thumbs down. It's a thumbs up that we're spending X millions or billions on this thing. Allow people to see for themselves. There's technology now, and there are platforms that empower people to, frankly, just let them think for themselves for a change. And I think that's wonderful. I just love it. Whatever your opinion. Here's where I stop at the water's edge. We don't have our own opinions. What's good and bad in politics? But
is there something baked into C-SPAN, though? And, I'm a huge fan of Brian Lamb and of Susan Swaim, who is, currently running the show at C-SPAN. Is there an ideology baked into, kind of having a surveillance camera on Congress?
That's fair.
Just to flip my cards, I think for me, it's like, the genius of C-SPAN is that it kind of puts a surveillance camera on, was it Mark Twain or Will Rogers said, was the only native criminal class in America, Congress. It seems to me, like the more you look at Congress, the more libertarian you're going to become.
Let me quote Jay Leno, who had a joke he trotted out every anniversary of C-SPAN. So C-SPAN began March 1979, when Congress went on TV. Every year there was an anniversary of that. Jay Leno's joke was always something like C-SPAN's working out so well. Congress is thinking of putting cameras in other high crime areas. Was his thing. So no, there are two big buckets of people: people who want to see politicians for themselves, the transparency, openness folks, and then there are the people who don't want the media shaping the narrative for them, who don't want to be talked to. Now, I will say, I'm flat out, I'm a capitalist. We are all capitalists. There's no government money in C-SPAN. It's a nonprofit funded and created by the cable industry.
Who are, the greatest, most upstanding people in, public interest, civic minded groups.
So to continue on, the networks, the cable networks, argue with each other, put the pundits on. They do that because you're going to pay millions of dollars for pundits. You're going to put them on TV. We don't have that part of the equation. There are no journalists or no celebrity journalists. This is flat out putting the hearings on and staying out of the way, editorially out of the way. So however you phrase it, which is great, almost like worshiping the altar of transparency, of saying we need to see for ourselves.
So you know, do you feel like, we're now in a, post-truth era, possibly a post-Trump era, or it might just be, we're in the interregnum between Trump presidencies. He might become Grover Cleveland 2.0, right? If he shows up again in 2024 and wins. But is it, talk about that kind of one thing that C-SPAN offers is the idea of information free of context or free of spin, right? So instead of going to NBC or MSNBC or Fox or something, and, where you get, partisans duking it out and on each station and on CNN, it might be more liberal than conservative or Republican than Democrat, whatever. But you guys are offering up kind of the thing itself. Does that lead to a, does that lead to a cacophony, to a kind of Tower of Babel effect where we're more polarized than ever?
That's very interesting. My instinct is to punt and say, leave that to the academics to figure out. There are people who say, and I don't agree with this, but there are people who say too much transparency is bad because, now you have, if you need the back door, you need the closed door meetings to make things happen. Not everything can be done in the open. And the anti-argument is, if it's done in the open, it's all theatrical at that point and the antics come to play. That's the people who are skeptical of transparency. I come from a position that the more we see of government, the better. The more we see of politicians, just the better, because these are taxpayer-paid positions.
Before we go any further in our recent interview with Howard Mortman, I want to take a minute to talk to you about today's sponsor, BetterHelp.com. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com. Are you feeling that something's preventing you from achieving your goals, interfering with your happiness? Are you having trouble sleeping? Do you have anxiety? Do you have worries that keep getting in the way of things? Then you've got to check out BetterHelp.com and add /TRI for the recent interview for a special offer. BetterHelp is going to assess your needs and match you with a licensed professional therapist. You'll be able to connect securely online or via phone. It's totally convenient. It's totally confidential. And you'll be communicating with somebody in less than 48 hours. This isn't a crisis line. It's not self-help. It's professional counseling online, securely online. You can send a message to your counselor anytime. You'll get responses that are thoughtful and timely. And you'll be able to have weekly sessions, either video or phone, whatever works for you. I've used this service in the past, and I was extremely happy with it. So it comes with my personal recommendation. But BetterHelp.com is committed to facilitating great therapeutic matches. You fill out a questionnaire, you get assigned to somebody. If that doesn't work out, then you try somebody else. You change. It's easy. It's so much easier than going to an office across town and burning a lot of time and travel and transit. It's more affordable than many traditional offline counseling. Financial aid is available as well, and you can use it anywhere in the country or for clients worldwide. We're talking about licensed professional counselors who specialize in everything from depression to stress to anxiety to relationships to sleeping to trauma, anger, family conflicts, grief, self-esteem, LGBT matters, you name it, they can help you with it. Everything is confidential, convenient, professional, affordable. Go to BetterHelp.com/TRI and you'll get 10% off your first month. Give it a shot. If you need help, it's a good place to go. BetterHelp.com/TRI. And now, back to the recent interview with Howard Mortman. You worked with Jack Kemp, it kind of is amazing to me to think about this, but, younger people have no idea who Jack Kemp was. He was an AFL quarterback for the Buffalo Bills and the Los Angeles Chargers. Way back in the day, a champion quarterback who became a congressman and then became a kind of perennial presidential candidate. He was a housing and urban development head. He was kind of a liberal Republican. He would call himself a bleeding heart conservative who ran for vice president on a ticket in 1996 with Bob Dole. Jack Kemp seems to be the type of character who does not really exist anymore. He's somebody who talked across the aisle, who seemed to mix kind of certain you know, very nice elements of liberal politics as well as kind of conservative politics. Is that right? Is a figure like Jack Kemp just not, just not possible anymore in contemporary American politics? And if so, is that a loss?
You know, it's funny because the best example to answer your question is Paul Ryan, who worked for Kemp. And I actually worked with Paul at the same time we worked for Jack Kemp at Empower America, which is an old think tank. So your question begs the real life example of somebody who was driven out, basically, for those. I mean, the Paul Ryan, Jack Kemp, you know, AI wing, you know, free market based wing, you know, others may have to argue whether it still exists. You know, we're talking about very much rooted in the 80s of tax, driven by tax cuts, driven by anti-communism, you know, and there's a lot of things that Jack Kemp advocated that conservatives found fault in. You know, he always had the knock of the big government conservative, you know, the aggressive foreign policy. So much of that.
Right. And also aggressive social policy. I mean, he wanted to build out public housing and give people ownership in, you know, where they could, ultimately, I think it was a benighted policy, but where, you know, people could own the apartment that they might have had in a housing project, that type of thing.
Right. And for him, home ownership, and that was one of the projects I worked on in HUD, was loomed big for him because it moved along the continuum toward private enterprise, toward private ownership, away from the government-owned housing and giving people a stake in their communities, managing their own property, and then taking the leap to owning the public housing. And these are always pilot projects, and they never really became huge.
They did not seem ultimately as implemented by HUD. They were not very cost-effective either.
No, they were expensive. They definitely, I mean, there was always a GAO like an audit. It always went on, how much does this cost? And it was tough to make the argument that if you just look at flat out saving taxpayers money, no. I mean, they never really flat out ended up with like less money cost. It was just more the opportunity of buying a piece of your own, you know, to pass on to your kids.
Kemp was also in Empower America, which was a think tank that he started with, if I'm remembering correctly, Vin Weber, who was a congressman from Minnesota, who was a centrist Republican, as well as Bill Bennett, who has, you know, continued on, you know, in a career where he's become more and more of a kind of conservative activist and voice and has had his own scandals about gambling and things like that. But one of the things that Empower America did in the 90s in California is they went out and Kemp, who was from Southern California, Bennett and Weber campaigned against Prop 187, which was an attempt to criminalize basically all welfare to illegal immigrants, as well as some legal immigrants. You know, Kemp as a pro-immigration Republican, that doesn't seem to exist anymore.
Yeah, it's funny that the language he used, talking about Ellis Island and talking about, you know, the great influx of how immigrants build this country. Yeah, that's language that's a little dated now. By the way, you mentioned Bennett and Kemp. The other pillar of Paramerica was Gene Kirkpatrick. Also would have been on like the pro-immigration side, foreign policy.
Right, but also the pro-intervention side, right? Yeah. Military intervention.
Oh, definitely. Yeah. America and all that. So yeah, that was part of it, right?
You were a producer for a few years at MSNBC for Hardball with Chris Matthews, thinking of another guy who, you know, he was like Mount Rushmore or something, right? You expected, you know, you would turn on the TV, Chris Matthews was on. He was on before you were born and he would be on after you died. Obviously, he has been flushed out of the system. And you were at a particular moment in MSNBC where people like, if I'm remembering correctly, Pat Buchanan had a show on MSNBC. Tucker Carlson had a show on MSNBC. What was it like to be at MSNBC before it had become kind of, you know, certifiably left of center and leaning into a kind of progressive democratic agenda?
So the really big thing that bothered me about that whole industry was the reliance on ratings. We would have post-show meetings, and we're talking about 2004, 2005, 2006, and it really was Hey, I'll give you a great example. I remember having a post-show meeting. We had Dan Quayle on, and the ratings plummeted for the 15 minutes he was on. And so we said in the post-show, never again. We'll never have Dan Quayle on again. But it's like, I'm thinking, my God, he's a former vice president of the United States. You can't dismiss him that easily. I mean, but he was, and that was all, you know, chasing ratings. I remember we came in one weekend. Martha Stewart, I think, was either jailed or sentenced one day, and we all came in because Martha Stewart would drive the ratings up. So we talked about Martha Stewart for an hour. So it was, ideological, much more now, much more with a bent now. But the worshiping then, it probably is, and obviously still is ratings. Now, again, that's the model. That's the market. That's totally fine. That's, you know, capitalists, how they make their money. It's just a very uncreative way to really, in my mind, produce TV. And
C-SPAN is still not doing ratings. They don't look at ratings. I mean, how do you guys evaluate whether or not your programs are, you know, worth a shit, to be blunt?
Sure. No, definitely. I mean, if that test is really... Here's where we're fortunate. We're fortunate still. So the no ratings is double-edged. We don't have the metrics of are people watching this, but the beauty of that is who cares? The beauty of that is, you know, we want to show this hearing on Medicare Part D because it's the right thing in the public service to do that. We want to show, we're taping this right now. We're showing the January 6th Select Committee hearing. And we're showing that in its entirety. Now, that's probably going to, you know, have a lot of viewers, a lot of networks involved in that. But we want to show hearings that are not the marquee, you know, air celebrity hearings, you know, the ones that are just the everyday stuff. And that's our world. That's our niche.
Yeah. You know, somebody like Chris Matthews, he started out working for Tip O'Neill. He became a newspaper columnist and a really major kind of talking head host. He was like Rachel Maddow. He was like, Bill O'Reilly in his time and day. He ended up being kind of squeezed out over some Me Too stuff. But it was also that he was at the end of a long career anyway. But does somebody like Chris Matthews, who kind of tries to define what matters in politics, you know, is it good or bad that characters like him are kind of, you know, have been pushed out of the scene? Are we in a better world where people are more openly ideological and or, kind of rooted in ideology rather than, you know, kind of a different type of conversation?
Yeah, I will answer your question honestly, and I feel like I'm fine C-SPAN hat territory. Say that I miss big, colorful characters in politics. You know, and you know, there was a time when you got this is. I'm trying to phrase this the right way, where politicians were just more interesting, rather than either being fleshed out by social media because you said or did the wrong thing that the Twitter mob is saying you're doing the wrong thing, or just the ideologically driven. But just I just feel like if you want to find really interesting people in American politics, you have to go backwards and dig them out, and the media as well. You know, it's for better or for worse, it seems that people are more careful, or if not more careful, you know, the mob is out to get them much faster.
But so is it, I mean, but it's kind of a weird thing, right? Because maybe the typical politician, say somebody like Barack Obama, right? It was very kind of careful. You could see that in everything he was saying, it was intentional, buttoned down. But then you also have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene. Right. Or Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, et cetera. You know, like you have people who are wild, and then you have people like, you know, really out there, like Marjorie Taylor Greene, stuff like that.
The thing is, we show her. I mean, she's on the floor of the House speaking, and C-SPAN, every time she speaks, we show her because we show everybody. So, you know, we don't cancel anybody because people find them disagreeable or what their message is. She's been elected and she says things, and when we show her press conferences too, you know, she has a press conference.
Yeah.
She's part of the mix of politics these days.
So you also worked at National Journal for a long time. And National Journal was this, you know, I started at Reason in the early 90s. And I started coming to DC on a regular basis in the very late 90s, early 2000s. National Journal was the go-to publication where it was small circulation, but it literally cost like tens of thousands of dollars a year for a subscription. Everybody inside the Beltway read it. If you had access to it and you watched talking head shows, you realize that like most of the people who were pretending to be insiders were just cribbing stuff from National Journal. I don't even know if it exists anymore. Like the world that National Journal, and there were things like Congressional Quarterly and Roll Call, which still exists in some form, you know, these powerful, insular, major, but kind of subterranean media outfits don't really exist the way that they do anymore. Is that accurate? And if they don't, is that a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah, so National Journal, the hotline, it was part of an era. So we charge $6,000 per subscription.
6-0?
6-0-0-6K.
Wow, $60,000.
3 zeros after the six. Six.
Yes.
Okay.
6,000.
Yeah.
6,000, okay.
You know, something, or 5,000, something, you know.
Yes.
Like Steve Martin, you know, well, 5,000 or 6,000, don't really know that.
Yeah.
So what you end up with, and here's the beauty of it, you end up with people saying, I really need to have that because it costs $6,000. I got to subscribe to that because it'll make me smarter. This was in a day when this was the only game in town. There was, you know, if anything, like Politico and others have flattened that where you don't need $6,000 to know what's happening. But there's a time you did need $6,000 to know what's happening a year. For me, I love those days and I miss those days. And the problem is, you know, it's like Saturday Night Live. You keep saying, well, it was so much better in the old days. It's not funny anymore. I don't want to say that because it's still around and there's still very great people working and putting out the hotline every single day. But when I was there, we were the only ones doing anything like that. And it was a heck of a lot of fun. And it was creative. And it was the ultimate making fun of politics without making fun of it. You know, just like being part of, you know, is, you know, mischievously quoting people, you know, just like, here's what they said. And by quoting somebody, that was mocking them because look at what they said kind of thing.
So can you think of a specific example that you remember fondly?
Well, I'll tell you the biggest mistake I ever made was Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell of Colorado. And my mistake was I put Nighthorse in quotation marks for his name. So Senator Ben Nighthorse Campbell was probably my biggest error. The best thing we ever did at the hotline, believe it or not, was we put Letterman's top 10 list in every single issue. And people always told us, I don't change anything you want, change the quote of the day, change this, change that. Just always put Letterman's top 10 list at the back because we drove a lot of attention that way. But okay, quickly, now it is coming to me. Here's an example. Our quote of the day, the most prominent quote on the front page, the hotline every day. We had reporters call us up and say, hey, did you see what I said on Chris Matthews? It was brilliant. Make that quote of the day. Now, Nick, you're going to say, give me names of examples. And I have them, but I'm not going to give them to you because they are still alive and still writing. But the reporters did angle to become a quote of the day back in the day.
So do you, you know, you have a politics, I suspect, and one can divine your politics, at least in broad strokes, from your resume and whatnot. You know, but at the same time, do you feel like reporters, you know, back in, say, the late 90s and early 2000s, ideological, yes, or everybody has a politics, everybody has an ideology, but that people were more or less ideological in a way that got in the way of telling stories or of figuring out what is important and what needs to be discussed?
You know, I will say this. You mentioned my political background is public. I'm proud of it. I'm not even ashamed. Having worked in partisan politics is part of who I am. I think that adds to a reporter by a media person by giving them enhanced experience in what they're covering. I actually think that is a strength. I would say also, I vote, and I know the reporter saying, I refuse to vote. I mean, Leonard Downey and others said, oh, we're not even going to vote. I think that's absurd. I mean, we have the right to vote that so many people fight for. I want to use it. Now, that should not come into play. Here's a great example. Abe Rosenfeld of the New York Times once told reporters, I'm not going to use the foul language here, but he once told reporters saying, I don't care if you're having sex with the elephant, as long as you're not covering the circus thing. So it's like, you know, I think having experience in real life politics campaigns is a net plus for someone in the media, but they just can't have that cloud how you report and do your job. And I think there are a lot of reporters who are able to pull that off.
Do you think, though, that the press, you know, kind of the mainstream press or the legacy press, which, you know, in a way you've been part of and you've moved away from, you know, but is the legacy media more ideological than it used to be? You know, is that a good or a bad thing?
So here's where that becomes a problem. If you go to campuses, college campuses, and you ask them, and I've done this, I've talked about C-SPAN in college campuses. I always ask them, like in journalism classes, I say to journalism classes, you know, we're here to talk about C-SPAN. You never heard of us. You may not watch us, but I'm going to show you some neat video. But first, how do you guys get your news? And overwhelmingly, when I ask the question, how do you get your news? They say, well, I get my news from NPR, from the NPR app, or I get it from the New York Times, or I get my news from CNN and MSNBC. And what I find dispiriting about that is that they are getting their news from one side sources. I wish they would be more balanced in how they got their news from the right, you know, from conservative sources. Not necessarily, I'm not in a position to say that, you know, they are the right voices to hear, but it's a balance. And I think future reporters, future journalists need, and journalism professors need to be teaching all sides, just like academics, just like historians, you know, predominantly, you know, liberal driven academia, for the benefit of the students, need to be exposed to all voices. So it's kind of a self-regulating thing. You know, if reporters are predominantly of one ideology, it's I think that's a bad thing, regardless of what the ideology is.
Do you think that helps explain, you know, there's a broad-based decline in trust and confidence in American institutions of both public and private life, you know, and whether we're talking about the Boy Scouts and the Catholic Church or the United Way for kind of nonprofit organizations, but then also, you know, big business, you know, people are look askance at for the most part, and certainly in politics and the media, you know, if, you know, however bad Donald Trump was doing with the American public, you know, the media as an entity was doing worse. Do you think that's partly because people feel like they're being lied to, or they're given, so, you know, we're just getting the, you know, we're getting 4 seconds of the Zapruder film from the media rather than the whole thing. Do you think that's, you know, that helps explain why the media is in, you know, objectively a lower, you know, era of trust and confidence than it was, you know, 50 years ago?
So my way of deflecting your premise-based question, Nick, is to say, if your trust in the media is descending and you have less trust and you want to see for yourself what is happening, what the news is, I have a place for you to watch, and that's C-SPAN.
Okay. So you guys would have run the entire Zapruder film, right? Of, you know, all 6 seconds of it.
From Love Field all the way to the Park Lawn Hospital. That's right. We would have done the whole thing. That's right. Let you form your own decision on what happened. That's right.
Well, that would have been useful, too. I mean, you know, because one of the things that's puzzling really about the, you know, the broad-based decline in trust and confidence in America is that I don't know what people were thinking in the mid-60s, you know, which is generally when these surveys started, and there are high points. And it's like, you know, you saw the Zapruder film, it was shown like once, and then there were some frames were in Life magazine, and then it disappeared for like 15 years, you know, from public view. And that happens off again and again, where it was clear the government was, you know, was manipulating or withholding information in cahoots with, you know, with large media institutions. So in a way, I mean, I think everybody's right to have less trust and confidence, but we need to build that back somehow. You know, from a kind of media literacy point of view, because I think that's one of the great functions of C-SPAN. You watch it and you have to form your own opinions. You know, the viewer has to do the work, which I think is great. What are some of your pointers to for people to become better, you know, kind of more thoughtful consumers of media and news?
Wow, that's a great, great question. I think you need to know motivations behind what a politician is saying. I think you need to, you know, the more you research somebody, you know, here's an example. I want to be careful on this, but I think politicians are allowed to change their mind on policy. I think people can grow and people have different opinions. What becomes more interesting is when they change their minds on politics, on situational. You know, I'm for getting rid of the filibuster when a certain party is in power. Now I'm against it because a different party is in power. That's where it gets tricky.
Yeah, it's either it's literally a nuclear option that will, you know, drop the equivalent of hydrogen bombs on the Constitution, or it's the last thing between us and pure plutocracy or something, right? And I mean, the same people you mentioned, Harry Reid earlier, he's the one. I mean, he did a 360 degree tap dance all around kind of judicial and legislative filibusters in his, you know, just in the aughts.
Yeah, and again, you're right, and our video library, our archives are full of politicians saying one thing one era and saying a different thing another era, and not in policy. We'll just punt that, but just in terms of the politics of who's in power and how things should be governed. So that involves a little bit of work, though, on by the news consumer. You've got to do a little bit of research. We hope that people do and go to our archives, but that's where you can really, you know, search by a politician's name and just see what he or she used to say about something and now what they're saying now.
To bring it back to your book, When Rabbis Bless Congress, The Great American Story of Jewish Prayers on Capitol Hill, you mentioned in the book that, you know, it was kind of big news nationally when the first rabbi spoke in, you know, before Congress, when James Buchanan was president, before Lincoln had been inaugurated. And then 100 years later, I guess it was, or thereabouts, that the first female rabbi spoke, and it didn't really, nobody cared.
This is really interesting history. The first female rabbi ordained in America was 1972. It took a long time, and that's a whole different podcast, that history. So, but once the first rabbi was ordained, her name is Rabbi Sally Prizan, still alive from New York. She prayed in Congress in 1973. And prayed, gave the prayer on the day that the House voted to send the impeachment proceedings to the Judiciary Committee against Nixon. So it was a big history day. She never mentioned in her prayer that she was a woman, never mentioned her milestone, never even mentioned God in the prayer for that matter. That's a different part of this, but never mentioned the pioneering part of it. But the woman who sponsored her, a woman who you remember, Bella Abzug, the Big Hats, sponsored her. And did make a big deal about her being the first woman. Now, so if you start the clock then, 1973, since then, there have only been, now I can use the word only because we've started the clock, there have only been 14 women rabbis since then, when there have been 100 or so male rabbis since then who have done it. So that part of the story needs a little more bucking up to get more women rabbis involved.
I once saw Bella Abzug, who had been a congresswoman from New York, at the Melrose Games, which is an indoor track meet that used to be held in Madison Square Garden. And she was going to be a celebrity starter. And all of the people who were celebrities that were announced to the crowd that day were booed loudly because it was New York in the 70s. And, you know, more power to those people. I think they kind of perfectly capture the public mood in a lot of ways. Are you, you know, when you think about, I guess in a certain way, the long story of your book, which is, you know, you have a, you know, Jewish people in America are a tiny minority, you know, a couple percentage points of the overall population, certainly bigger in places like New York City, but, you know, generally small. You know, have been thoroughly integrated into American life. There's anti-Semitism exists, but not in any way, shape, or form like that which many Jews escaped by coming to the United States and over time to be Jewish. There was a time maybe 100 years ago, 120 years ago, where being Jewish did not mean you were part of mainstream America. And, you know, those days are gone. Are you optimistic? We live in a time now where, you know, everything seems to be extremely polarized. There is a huge amount of tension along racial and ethnic lines, along gender lines, along sexual orientation and sexual identity. Do you think, in 100 years that, your grandchildren will be writing a book about, when the first trans, Muslims or transhumanist religious people spoke to Congress, and that it'll be kind of a similar story of assimilation and acculturation?
Yeah, I love that question. I'll answer this way. Going back to the first woman rabbi was also a time when there were other first spy women in Congress, the first woman priest, guest chaplain. So the early 70s, Billie Jean King, we talk about everything that happened to ERA, reflecting of the times. So if you take what you're suggesting, the possibility of a trans imam, for example, if that is, and it's a totally serious way of looking at it, if that is what is common in society then, I would imagine that will be reflected in who is appearing in Congress giving prayers. This is very much the language they use and who they are, very much reflective of American society at that moment. So if that's where we're headed, I would imagine, yes, we will see this.
Absolutely. And I hope, if there is a Congress in 100 years, that I guess today's prayers that modern monetary theory is actually, somehow rooted in reality is a reality, will come true.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of an example. During the Vietnam War, a lot of the language was first became pro-truth, pro-war in the prayers. And then as you started losing, reflecting American society, pulled back and say, we need to bring home and address issues at home and, the great society and so on. So yeah, it's mirroring what we as a country are experiencing.
Okay, we're going to leave it there. I've been talking with Howard Mortman. He's a director of communications for C-SPAN, and he's the author of the new book, When Rabbis Bless Congress, The Great American Story of Jewish Prayers on Capitol Hill. Howard, thanks for talking.
Thank you, Nick, very much.
This has been The Reason Interview with Nick Gillespie. Please subscribe to this podcast at Apple, Google, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, wherever you get your podcasts, or go to reason.com/podcasts and sign up there. Thanks for listening.